Mississippi River Valley of Wisconsin and Illinois. A few months earlier, I had hatched a plan with Moon Yeast to access Knife Lake in the winter by dog sled. This would allow a perspective on the Younger Dryas, a cooling anomaly that kicked in 12,800 years ago and changed the course of the first people. Moon Yeast had gone to the site only in warmer months, when waterways were open, accessing Knife Lake by canoes with gear and crew for the dig. I wanted to see the site in its cold phase. We picked the wrong winter to attempt our trek. By the start of 2014, the outfitter supplying the dogs and sleds said the snow was too deep and the nights were too cold. The polar vortex had unraveled and was frosting the continent down to Texas, 20 degrees in Houston. The outfitter wasn't sending anyone out at 50 below zero, neither dog nor man. I opted instead to hike across a corner of nearby Lake Superior, stomping ahead in moon boots and dragging a toboggan loaded with gear on a frozen, empty bay south of the Apostle Islands. Moon Yeast wisely declined, and for a few days I was adrift in searing cold. The name Younger Dryas comes from the diminutive, hardy Dryas octopetala flower, whose presence in soil horizons tells how far south in Europe polar conditions reached. Frigid climates are marked by these ground-hugging, white-petaled flowers. Younger refers to the fact that there was an older Dryas, a cooling spell that occurred around 14,000 years ago. It lasted a century. The Younger Dryas lasted 1,000 years. The cooling event I witnessed from Lake Superior was my own Younger Dryas in miniature. It began in late 2013 with a warming episode in Asia. India grew hotter than usual and bounced a dome of warm air off the Tibetan plateau into the stratosphere. The jet stream, a governor of northern climates, was severed, upsetting the polar vortex over the Arctic. The vortex reversed itself from its original counterclockwise movement and began turning clockwise instead. It's a worrisome change when a planet flips one of its primary circulation patterns. Cold air pushed through the weakened jet stream and escaped southward, creating climatic mayhem at the top of the planet. Lake Superior froze more solidly than it had in almost five decades. Ice would still be floating in the lake through May. The Younger Dryas began 12,800 years ago, essentially restarting the Ice Age, returning to polar conditions that had been phasing out over the previous several thousand years. Within a decade, the Northern Hemisphere went from warming straight back to deep and windy cold. The main cause was likely a thermohaline issue. Floods of fresh, cold meltwater began coming off North America, entering the slowly warming Atlantic Gulf Stream, which, like the jet stream, is a climate governor for the Northern Hemisphere. Salt water sank under the inundation of fresh water, and the surface began to freeze solid, reversing the belt-like circulation of the Gulf Stream. Rather than shuttling warm equatorial waters north as it had for 6,000 years, the Gulf Stream now began pulling cold North Atlantic waters south. Icebergs began showing up off the Atlantic coast of Florida. The most likely trigger was flooding from a giant lake that had built up against the previously shrinking Laurentide ice sheet. The freshwater burst happened as the retreating ice collapsed, allowing a lake 10 times the size of Lake Superior to pour out and reach the sea. Another large meltwater discharge came from a shrinking ice dome that spilled at once into the Arctic Ocean via the Mackenzie River. These floods might have been enough to turn the Ice Age engine back on. This new, 1,000-year-long cold spell was devastating to megafauna, sending the last big animals out of the Ice Age and into extinction. But humans took the change and ran with it, adapting to the new conditions and breaking into technologically distinct groups. Stemmed points outpaced fluted, becoming floristic. Styles diversified. Great Basin points from mid-continent, straight-stemmed Lake Mojave projectiles along the California-Nevada border, squat-bottom wind dust-stemmed points from the Pacific Northwest. Cougar mountain points from the upper Great Basin held on to the oldest traits, still resembling those found in Paisley Caves from a few thousand years earlier. Clovis, as a continental manifestation, ended with the start of the Younger Dryas and spread into numerous regional offshoots. Weapons mostly became smaller and more intricately made to match the new prey size. By becoming even mildly isolated, fluted technology evolved rapidly, styles dividing into many. Long, fluted, almost absurdly Clovis-like projectiles with delicate owl ears at the bottom were manufactured in Lower Appalachia and throughout the Tennessee River Basin. Shorter, thumb-sized Folsom points spread across the high plains. The biblical story of Babylon comes to mind, a mythic time when all people spoke the same language. They gathered to build a city and a great tower, which God promptly destroyed. At that moment, the people could not understand each other, as if suddenly speaking Babel. They had been granted mutually unintelligible languages. Forced into diversity, they scattered from each other into tribes and clans. In late Ice Age America, technologies diverged, and probably dialects and languages along with them. Once few, people became many. Smaller fluted points appeared in western Alaska near the edge of the dwindling land bridge about 12,000 years ago, backwashing into Asia, where a fluted point was found at the Uptar site in Kamchatka. Fluted points also appeared in caves in southern Chile about 11,000 years ago. Despite the cold, or maybe because of it, styles were flourishing. It was a hard, swift break on the pool table of America. The Younger Dryas, the cue ball. Before meeting with Muñiz, I had set up a simple camp on the white expanse of Lake Superior on the north shore of Wisconsin. No tent, just a bag, bivy, and the toboggan I hauled behind me onto the lake's surface. The only heat I carried was my body, which was enough till about midnight, the first night between Ashland and Washburn. After that, it was a struggle to keep rolling and cupping whatever warmth I could to avoid frostbite. I'd gone out for a taste of full glacial conditions, listening to lake ice splinter and buckle beneath me, the lake's surface crushing itself at 30 degrees below zero. What I found in this slice of the Younger Dryas was mostly misery, which might have been the point. After getting no sleep, crawling out after sunrise from zippers frozen solid, and trying to start my stove with a lighter in clear frigid sunlight, the gas too cold to ignite, I became convinced that the people living against ancestral Great Lakes and the ice sheet in the Younger Dryas must have been seasonal migrants from the south, coming only in warmer months. I thought I should tell Muñiz this. They were in Florida, warming their toes in the winter. I was sure of it. But I was not Paleolithic. I was a very cold person from the Holocene. Instead of hauling a toboggan of gear, I would have been moving rocks, taking prizes from Knife Lake out to where I could trade or fashion them into weapons. Archaeologist John Lambert at UC Davis studied private collections of paleo projectiles found on the prairie of eastern Wisconsin and traced the rocks back to their sources. He found that while some late Pleistocene artifacts were made with local raw materials, the majority came from high-quality exotic tool stones transported 300 to 500 kilometers, many coming from around the Great Lakes and the top of Minnesota. Lambert noted that toolkit composition in the region reflects a reliance on long-distance movement, and that the rocks were transported along a north-south axis. That fit my personal hypothesis that they were wintering in Florida. Or in Tennessee, where projectiles similar to those around the Great Lakes were being made, barns or Cumberland points. Muñiz didn't picture them ranging as far as I envisioned, but we agreed, people did not stop moving when the Ice Age turned back on. I looked into an office and knocked on the door jamb. Muñiz turned from his desk and welcomed me in. A stout, broad-shouldered man, probably good in a brawl, he was in his 40s and would have done fine alongside me, freezing his ass off on the face of Lake Superior. I piled my coats in the corner because they wouldn't fit on his door hook. He asked where I finally ended up. When I told him out near the Apostle Islands, he laughed and said he'd made the right decision. Muñiz had his desktop open, layers of student work, grants, documents of survival for a university archaeologist. The desk had books and papers stacked, illustrations of preforms and points. He told me that during a winter like this, you think about being anywhere but here, Florida maybe, cottonmouths, alligators, and all. Muñiz had cut his teeth on Paleolithic sites along the Osceola River. He spoke of hot summer days when he'd dive into a hole and sink to the bottom, cooler and cooler as the weight belt carried him down. He held his arms out in front of him, showing how he'd descend as if in space. Landing on the bottom in darkness, breathing out of a regulator, he would wait several minutes for the sediment of his arrival to settle. He'd listen to his breath and bubbles rising, no light, not even a faint sun. Flicking on a 1,000-watt spotlight, he described how megafauna bones would appear, his spotlight bouncing off of them through the tannic water like gold. "You ever see Pulp Fiction," he said, "where they open the briefcase and they're looking into it? I knew the scene, and you don't actually see what's in the briefcase, but whenever they open it, you see the glow on their faces, their eyes frozen for a moment over something mysterious, entrancing." He said, "That's what it was like." Now he's researching cold period people who acquired stone and fashioned it into tools and transportable rock at the frigid, newly expanding edge of the Laurentide ice sheet. While the coasts were shrinking from sea level rise, fresh earth was exposed by glacial retreat over the previous several thousand years. At its greatest extent, the Laurentide reached across most of Minnesota and covered all of nearby Canada. It had melted and collapsed more than 100 miles back before the Younger Dryas. Then it slowly began to grow again, looming like a dome across Ontario, spilling icebergs into the chalky expanse of ancestral Lake Duluth. French fur traders in the 18th century called the lake around Mounice's site Lac du Couteau, Lake of Knives. They got this from Ojibwe people, who called it Mukoman Zagaigan, which means Knife Rock Lake, a place where knives could be made from rock. Radiocarbon dates from the site put its original use at 12,000 years ago. Mounice told me that these people might have been recent arrivals from the North Country, part of a movement coming down the ice-free corridor, people who knew something about cold, perhaps preferred it. The Younger Dryas may have been their time to flourish. He said the people who came here for toolstone were firmly in touch with the larger geography, moving their resource out of Knife Lake, 200 to 300 miles into surrounding regions, while weapons found in the area came from different continental traditions. Long, lancelet points appeared at the quarry site, Clovis-like, though intentionally not fluted, and yet also with a stemmed design, showing a mix of techniques at the dawn of the Holocene. Similar points are found across the Midwest and into the North Plains and the newly exposed land of Canada. They're similar, in turn, to points found at the Mesa site north of the Brooks Range in Alaska, a sign of a later group possibly coming down through the ice-free corridor, connecting northern Alaska with the American interior. Mounice does not see a well-populated land 12,000 years ago. Instead, he envisions remote lake edges, hundreds of miles between one band of hunter-gatherers and another. The Younger Dryas people, who arrived at the shores of Lake Duluth, may have been caribou and muskox hunters tracking edges of ice and lakes, finding this shiny source of siltstone out here like a gem. He showed me maps of the original shorelines, the quarry out on a lake in what must have been the middle of nowhere, tundra and permafrost, winters frozen solid. "There are plenty of animals elsewhere, plenty of other good stone," Mounice said. "To me, their arrival has got to be exploration, but it's hard to build a scientific interpretation when it's human nature." Mounice took me to the lab through empty hallways, unlocking doors, the building humming to itself with one perpetual breath, air ducts rattling. Pulling out drawers, bags, and boxes, he displayed samples of stones he and his students collected, hundreds upon hundreds of large flakes, unfinished blanks, bifacial knives, end scrapers, adzes, and preforms. He passed one after another to me, pressing them into my hands. The rocks told him that this was a prep zone, where flakes were knocked off, mass reduced, preforms made and ready to go. A supply of roughed out bifaces, enough to carry and make the trip worth it, could easily be made in a few hours and hauled away. He'd watched how his students on the dig and survey crew set up their tents around the quarry, clustered together for the most part, some set off a ways. This, he imagined, was the way people did it 12,000 years ago, settling themselves on the land, leaving fire hearths and chipping areas, temporary camps for seasonal cycles. He showed me what he thought was an overshot flake, a memory of Clovis. Some of the almost finished projectiles he'd picked up were long and intimidating. He called them shock and awe weapons. I asked him about the fall of Clovis at the start of the Younger Dryas. I wouldn't call it a fall, he said, more like diversified. Whether Clovis was a people, a technology, or a cult, it had to adapt or perish. The focus on mammoths had to change. Now, bison, muskox, caribou, and elk were the largest animals. Muñiz doesn't see people dying off, but adapting, taking on new appearances and locations in the archaeological record. You know the difference between Clovis and us, Muñiz said. When the climate changed and things got rough, Clovis had somewhere to go. Before visiting Muñiz, I spent only one night on the lake. As temperatures dropped to around 30 below zero, where it doesn't seem to matter if it's Celsius or Fahrenheit, Paleolithic or Holocene, I kept imagining direwolves or the tusked hulk of a proboscidean appearing on the half-light of the ice. If any were still alive after the Younger Dryas, this might have been the place to see them, a mastodon found in the southern Great Lakes region dated to between 10 and 11,000 years old, one of the final survivors before extinction, a last lost individual. After that sleepless night, fending off frostbite, I marched inland to camp in a snow shelter that I'd helped build a few days earlier with students from a college in Ashland, Wisconsin. This was my version of adaptation. I wasn't going to try another night on the lake under these collapsed polar vortex conditions. The shelter I helped construct was a Quincy, a circular room with a domed interior dug out of snow. It could sleep five or six. The entrance was a hole as wide as your hips, like slipping into an underground burrow. I crawled into it that night, pushing gear ahead of me, anything that I didn't want to freeze solid outside. My down sleeping bag was like an animal carcass, and I sat in it wearing my boots. It felt as if I were deep inside the earth, no sound, no sense of direction. Students had left tea candles and a thermometer. I lit the candles in a circle, my anorak hood pulled back, then the layers of warm caps and mitts off, fingers feeling the air. My breath curled around my head, fogging the ceiling. Inside temperature rose from minus 27, leveling off at 10 below, which felt comfortable enough that I unzipped my layers of jackets. As I entered my bag for the night, one candle remained lit. Its wick drew up the last clear wax, a soft light cast across the snow-packed floor and walls, ceiling made of scrape marks from snow shovels. I lay on my back, reading the marks like cuneiform. The candle sputtered, gave a few winks, and the chamber fell into darkness. No stars, no sky, no earth. I could hear my breath. How many nights, I wondered, did they sleep this way, going under for winter, hiding from the wild and toothy exterior? I thought of the huts and caves, the shallow shelters of bluefish and paisley, the rough hole of Pendejo Cave on the other side of Otero Mesa outside of White Sands. This is where, at the beginning of time, Raven strolled along a shoreline and came upon a mysterious clamshell. It was closed tightly. He put his ear to the shell, and inside he could hear breathing. Chapter 11. The Party at the Beginning of the World. 11,000 years ago. Fires and spotlights lit the distant sky, the night beginning to glow. If we'd been closer, we could have heard drums and seen soaring flames, but we were still days away from the city. In the morning, I opened my eyes to clear, clean light. It was the sunlight of the Holocene, the glacial age giving up its ghost. I had spent the night on the floor of this waterless lake in the desert of northwest Nevada, Lake La Huntan, one of the largest water bodies on the continent 11,000 years ago. It once covered parts of Nevada, California, and Oregon, back when glaciers were melting, rain clouds gathering, and the Younger Dryas was over. The lake has become a network of dusty inlets, peninsulas, and pans across the Black Rock Desert. We'd camped between ragged mountains in a small protected bay, its floor as smooth as a skating rink. Other sleeping bags were out, some occupied, some not, six in total. Backpacks were strewn around, signs of travel. Not much was needed on a summer night here, a limp sack of down to crawl into, the slightest cool of evening already washed away by sunrise. I got up and put on a thin sarong, a sunshirt, hat, and walked off barefoot. We brought the lightest gear, no stoves, no coffee. Bullets lay on the ground from people shooting at nothing, target practice on the horizon. None of the bullets, 22s and 45s, were marred or misshapen. They'd been fired and flew across the pan until they lost momentum, skidding on soft sediment as if landing in a pillow. I collected a handful, like finding marbles, then cast them back out. At the close of the Ice Age, at least 10 distinct groups in the Americas can be identified through their stone tool and weapon traditions. Archaeologist Michael Fott, currently mapping the floor of the Gulf of Mexico for early human inhabitants, identifies these 10 lithic groups as Nenana, Denali, Fluted Point, Western Stemmed Point, Flake Tool, Flake and Biface Tool, Fishtail Point, Pijon, Uruguay, and Paranaibo. Paleolithic America was never a monolithic culture. It was always many cultures, especially near the end as people divided and came together. Fott wrote that skeletal samples have revealed that later Holocene crania in North America have similarities with Northeast Asian samples, but early Holocene remains in Western North America, Middle America, and South America do not. These earlier samples have more cranial facial similarities with Australian, African, or Melanesian populations. The salient point is that diversity is indicated. The couple in our group, a fiddle player from Bali named Etta Wediyanto and her lanky Grand Canyon River Guide boyfriend, Thomas Patrick O'Hara, were curled up like a pair of caterpillars in their joined sleeping bags. The rest of us were single and up for the day. John Tevetan, an ER doc who used to work on the Hopi Reservation, played mandolin as he strolled into sunrise. Q, the same guy who joined me on the Harding ice field, a brawny Alaskan-born photographer, was out with a tripod, time-lapsing shadows as the first sun shattered the mountains. Timmy O'Neill, a climber friend, a stand-up comedian and drummer in a rock band, was already shirtless and juggling, wandering across the playa throwing balls in the air. We were a traveling minstrel show. Timmy would play the drums on whatever he could find, water bottles, knife blades, or rocks. He'd brought a tambourine with him. The doctor had his mandolin. Etta played fiddle. O'Hara, a guitar. Q sang sometimes between filming, and I'd drop in to chant a story to their howls and drum beats, O'Hara singing behind me with so much force that his neck veins popped out, performing to nothing but desert. We were taking our show to the city being built beyond the arms and peaks of La Huntan, the site of Burning Man. Its glow brightened as we approached night by night. Spotlights fanned from behind layers of mountains, still 6 days away. The glow was a beacon. It said, come. Burning Man, our camp, and everything at eye level this morning would have been 900 feet below the waves, a ghost circus in the murky depths of Lake La Huntan. When early people were here, they occupied the surrounding shores and palisades, looking across water and islands. One type of artifact they left, unique to Lake Country, is the lunate crescent, a kind of weapon, scraper, or cutting tool found among marshes, estuaries, and islands from the Intermountain West to the California coast. Also known as a butterfly or winged crescent, this stone weapon or tool, no one is sure how it was used, appeared around 12,000 years ago during the Younger Dryas. Based on where it's found around water, the artifact is believed to have been associated with bird hunting or skinning, though one crescent tool produced signs of pronghorn blood, and I've thought it could have as easily been used on fish. These stone crescents are typically thin, flat, and the length of your finger, as symmetrical as a boomerang. They often have grinding around the midline to facilitate hafting onto a wooden shaft. It may be coincidental, but their distribution follows flyways for tundra swan, greater white-fronted goose, snow goose, and Ross's goose, lending credence to the crescent being an implement designed for hunting birds. Whatever they were used for, they were unique to this part of the world, possibly a regional clan of bird hunters strung along lakes at the end of the Ice Age in the American West. As I strolled across the bottom of La Huntan, I came upon four ibises. They stood at attention, with stilt legs and long shadows. When they stiffened, I stopped. These were water birds, their element conspicuously absent. They seemed shy and, for all their grace, awkward. They may have landed here like us, curling up instinctively in the cup of a long-gone bay, the only place they could find that looked like water. This was one of the last great western lakes to evaporate. One bird took a step, and another, and they stilled, their bodies black against the rising sun, the playa turning into light around them. The numbers of birds coming through here now are infinitesimal compared to the Ice Age. These pans are still used as flyways, and what few lakes remain are busy wintering grounds. During the late Pleistocene and the first few thousand years of the Holocene, millions of water birds are thought to have leapfrogged these lakes every season. The lunate crescent followed them, and when most of the lakes finally dried up and flyways scattered 8,000 years ago, the lunate crescent went out of use. The ibises and I watched each other like unexpected strangers, not sure how to relate. Beyond the playa, mountains rose like nunataks, summits pierced through ice, through the chalky sediments of the lake bottom. I took a wide detour around the birds, not wanting to make their journey any more difficult. I wished for them actual lakes, wherever they could be found in this drying age. Most of the continent was hit hard by the chill of the Younger Dryas at the Ice Age's end, but not every place suffered. Lake La Hontan and its many surrounding sister lakes reached their biotic climax in the thousand-year-long cold spell. This was ideal country, plenty of water, mid-latitude warmth, far enough away from the glaciated Rockies and the coastal ranges not to be hemmed in by ice, its lake shores rich in marshes and fishing. The geology has a wealth of jaspers and cherts and good obsidian sources not far away for making tools and weapons. Terraces are plumed in tufa formations from freshwater springs that would have poured into the lake like fountains. It was yet another Eden in a long history of discoveries. The Black Rock Desert has kept summers of field schools going with researchers, grads, diggers, and mappers. This is one of the Paleolithic center points of North America, the Intermountain West, chained with great dry lakes from Paisley Caves in Oregon to White Sands in New Mexico. Lake La Hontan was the largest, with 8,500 square miles of surface area, 900 feet deep at its high stand. The mountains around our camp would have been islands, their summits reflected across the water. We were in the bottom, the muddy floor, now hard-packed and dry. People who lived at this lake were big and small game hunters, shore fishers, eaters of marsh grass and apiacea roots, the same food that the first people in Paisley Caves had eaten. They used spear points and lunate crescents, some of their weapons identical to those found in Paisley Caves, meaning the stemmed tool tradition was alive and well through the end of the Ice Age. Perhaps by 11,000 years ago, people had forgotten where they came from, their stemmed weaponry no longer from the Pacific Rim, now from here. The giant predators were gone. Grizzlies, mountain lions, and timber wolves were the largest carnivores in their world. American lions, saber-tooths, direwolves, and the short-faced bears were legends from a world before, when monsters ruled the earth and humans fought for purchase. Faces dusty, packs heavy with water, we wound along lake shores as dust devils careened across the playa, columns of alkali twisting into the blank sky. I'd come to think of these whirlwinds as spirits, or ghosts, whatever word you might use. Even the tiny ones, the quick whips of air twisting in tight circles, are comments, words, recollections. The big ones thundered across the playa, large as houses, feeding the atmosphere with dust. It is a ghostly land when you pay attention. There are places you can't walk without a shiver trickling up your spine. Have you gone across the Navajo Reservation with its red butte towers and spikes of eroded volcanoes? Human bones wash out of the cut banks with pockets of beads and broken pottery. Everywhere you go, there are drums in the ground. Etched into the mountains, the terraces of La Hontan looked as if a dam had burst and drained out. Hundreds of feet above the playa, we walked through cliff edges and steep, crumbling slopes, contouring along these abandoned watermarks. We found occasional sites, old beaches flaked with butterscotch-colored stone people had brought in and chipped. Midday, we retreated under our umbrellas, except for Etta, who huddled beneath a light shawl, and O'Hara, weathered and middle-aged, sprawled in the sun and cooking like a lizard. Wind whipped across us as if exhaling from a furnace. Nobody had played music in a while. In the evenings, people would break out instruments, and sometimes during a water stop in the middle of the day. This afternoon, instruments stayed in their cases as wind streamed across the highest shore of the lake. The mountains around us were fissured with steep, rocky draws. Timmy, the climber, walked under his umbrella in the mid-afternoon swelter, looking for artifacts, while the rest of us lounged in our half-circles of shade, umbrellas propped up against the wind. He looked like an archaeologist on methamphetamines, bending down, picking up, putting back, swiftly moving to the next. He's always like this. I felt like a hobo around him, while he bobbed and flew like a hummingbird. Now he was after artifacts, the next shiny thing. I described the shapes I was seeking, and within half an hour he'd found four late-stage preforms, probably from the Paleoarchaic, a time bracket of a few thousand years, anywhere between the end of the Pleistocene and the beginning of the Holocene. It was a time of more rains and fewer snows than the Ice Age. Those who had survived the thousand-year winter of the Younger Dryas were now in the right position for the coming age. Once he heard he might find a Paleolithic spear point, Timmy started covering ground like a ferret. He walked in and out of draws, lean body on the move, picking up one piece, then another, bringing them back to show us under our umbrellas. He was finding more preforms, one of the original human travel tools. One was a cloudy white chert, two others were the local butterscotch. They were broken, tumbled down a draw, but they got me up, and I started walking, looking, reaching down, finding the wind-whittled edges of a scraper, and a core smaller than a fist from which knife blades had been cleaved. Soon, umbrellas were stowed in packs, and the six of us were following a trail of encampments. Every 100 feet or so was a new concentration, napping circles and hunt-ready spike camps. They'd positioned themselves on a palisade over the lake. I thought they were hunting deer, bison, or elk, prey large enough to warrant a projectile made from a hand-sized preform. Timmy wanted a final stage, Paleolithic projectile. I told him about the stemmed lance known as a hasket. One was found along a dry Utah lake bed, with the residue of proboscidian protein in its microscopic cracks. Timmy said he'd find one of those, too. What he found was a sunset camp looking across a pale gulf of lake bed. You could have run off the edge with a hang glider and taken flight with 1,000 feet to spare. The band broke out. Etta yawed on her fiddle as O'Hara and the doctor followed her up with their guitars. Instead of drumming, Timmy moved up and down the draws in evening light. He still wanted to find one of these great ancient points. He wouldn't, though. In decades of searching, I never have. The Ice Age was done, and people were still going. In the transition between geologic ages, they banded into groups, forming the first large aggregations, gathering at places like Lake La Hontan and its cadre of intermountain water bodies. Imagine fires on these shores, lights flickering far away, people letting each other know they were here. A rock art panel on a lake arm south of here had been attended to continuously from 14,800 years ago to the close of the Pleistocene, people coming back to it over and over for thousands of years. Another more condensed gathering place is in the northeast, where large camps collected around caribou drives. The largest site is Bull Brook, along the lower Ipswich River on the Atlantic edge of Massachusetts. Twice the size of any other gathering in the northeast, Bull Brook was a hunting locus in coastal tundra and woods. It appeared to have been used just once, 11,000 years ago, heavy in fluted weaponry, smaller than Clovis, more fitting for the prey size of the age. Bull Brook has been destroyed by development, the site lost since the 1950s. Before bulldozers moved in, an archaeological inventory mapped out the distribution of artifacts. 36 discrete sites, or encampments, were found in a circle or semicircle around a central area, with far fewer finds in the middle, a sort of plaza within a social aggregation. Artifacts found in the outer and inner rings are notably different and appear to be hierarchically organized. Fluted point production is concentrated in the innermost ring, while spurred stone gravers used for bone industries and punching through skins, as well as hide-working scrapers, are more common around the larger outer ring. The site was well-ordered, intentionally laid out. The circular arrangement is thought to have created a cohesive unit for the greatest number of people to face each other. Most of the rock resources at Bull Brook came from no closer than 150 miles away, sourced in New York, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire. One of the major sources, Musungan Chert, from northeast Maine, came from 250 miles away. Each discrete encampment at Bull Brook, where these rocks were found, was elliptical in shape, about 20 feet across, and contained fire hearths and burned bones. The entire site, at least what was found in a hasty archaeological survey, was about 500 feet across. The city we were heading toward in the Black Rock Desert was 2 miles across and was based on more or less the same footprint as Bull Brook, a ring of camps facing into an open center, each camp with its own purpose and show of artifacts. Like Bull Brook, this city was a single-use location. The next year, it would occupy a different part of the playa. The Bull Brook site is rivaled by a larger aggregation on the high plains of the Colorado-Wyoming border. This is a fluted stronghold called the Lindenmeyer site, the largest known concentration of the Folsom tradition. Folsom was a mobile bison hunting group that held the middle of the continent around 11,000 years ago. They were establishing themselves up high against the face of the Rockies, and their fires must have looked like a beacon. The layout and extent of Lindenmeyer is unknown, some of it eroded, some buried under 10 to 20 feet of sediment. Like Bull Brook, people came from all directions, stone sources arriving from 100 or more miles away. Kremling and tiger cherts poured in from a route across the Rockies, laid down in the Clovis Age. Red ochre was imported from 100 miles north into Wyoming at the Hell Gap site, an Ice Age ochre quarry that fed many archaeological sites on the High Plains. Before Lindenmeyer and Bull Brook, the late Pleistocene has little evidence of people gathering in extended groups. Mockingbird Gap in the Jornada of southern New Mexico is unusual. Buttermilk Creek in Texas, where flakes, weapons, and tools were stacked on each other for thousands of years, back to before Clovis, is even rarer. This appearance of camps gathered together is new. Greg Nunn would say they'd been doing this all along, but this is the first time they rise to the archaeological surface. Monster slayers had done the hard work, the great and terrifying beasts put down as people teamed up for the next age, the human age. Archaeologist Jason LaBelle oversees scientific research at the Lindenmeyer site in Colorado near the Wyoming border. On a crisp autumn morning, he brought his students out from Colorado State University, showing them the site they'd been studying in the classroom all semester. When he handed out pin flags, the students bobbed like sewing needles, marking flakes of rock and pieces of burnt bone winnowed to the surface. In places, the ground looked showered by cultural debris. When he sat on the ground and talked with his students at lunch, LaBelle said, "It must have been some kind of rainbow gathering or Burning Man." It was a greater concentration of Ice Age artifacts than you'll find almost anywhere in the Americas. "Imagine you have campfires up here," LaBelle said, gesturing at the view. "It's a sight to see out from, but it's also a sight to be seen. If you wanted to draw people to you, this would be your place." Lindenmeyer was found atop a sort of throne on the land, backing up into the Rockies and looking out over the plains, what LaBelle calls a viewshed. From here, you can see well into Wyoming and down to Pike's Peak standing over Colorado Springs, 140 miles to the south. It is one of the broadest habitable views in North America. LaBelle grew up on the flats east of Lindenmeyer. He said you could see the site from town. It was part of people's modern geography. It is the highest point attached to the High Plains, a place where Clovis was based before Folsom. He said that as a kid, instead of having posters of Star Wars and Farrah Fawcett on his bedroom walls, he put up a map of the Lindenmeyer site. He knows why it was here, because it could be seen. The rule of ancient people is visibility. Sitting in the dry autumn grass, he swiped his hand through the air, defining the larger geography. "We are now in the exact center of Folsom Territory," he said, cutting the horizon into quadrants. "Canada to Mexico and Illinois to the west side of Wyoming. We're in the middle of it." The locations he described are also the ranges of tool stones that ended up here. People were coming from all directions, sewing themselves more permanently into the fabric of time and earth by picking out a place they returned to again and again, leaving abundant archaeology. LaBelle mentioned obsidian found here, sourced back to Yellowstone, almost 400 miles to the north, and obsidian from a volcanic caldera in northern New Mexico, almost 400 miles to the south. Cherts were coming down from the Dakotas, and Edwards Plateau chert up from Texas. Looking across our viewshed, LaBelle said, "The Great Plains are impenetrable in a way. How do you navigate? Being up here is about navigation and meeting and companionship. Even if you've never been here before, you can see the way." After lunch, LaBelle and his students walked through colored bits and shards of chipped rocks, oranges, yellows, blacks. They found a knocked-out channel flake, speaking to the manufacture of small, fluted weapons. A student who'd been working summers as a budding archaeologist at the Hell Gap ochre excavations in Wyoming came upon what looked like eroded bone poking out of the dirt in an arroyo's exposed face. A few more students gathered around the bone, which appeared to be in an exposed dish of ash-colored soil, sure sign of a fire pit. Soon everyone was there, LaBelle advising them to pick just a little at this exposed cross-section, grains of soil letting free with tweezers and a pencil-thin bamboo probe meant for this kind of small exploratory work. It felt like a surgical operation, voices low, assistants stepping in to take artifacts handed to them. Within minutes, they'd uncovered edges of chert flakes, what looked like a piece of charcoal, and more bone as soft as chalk. With only a half inch of arroyo plucked away, they were opening a window into the Folsom Age, a camp buried by 11,000 years of dust storms and floods, arroyos filling each other with mud and later bisecting themselves, revealing what was buried. The more they found, the slower they picked, talking about a bison hunting camp. No more latifrons, now only antiquus, a highly adaptable bovid that met the demands of a warmer climate and dangerous atlatl throwers. As excitement built around this find in the arroyo, LaBelle said, "That's enough." One student asked if they shouldn't remove the bones and bag them, at least find out what they are. Another asked if there should be a pin flag left behind to mark their discovery. LaBelle said no, just leave it. As we walked away, he said to me, "Those things are all over the place." We took one of the higher summits to get a look around. 3 days from the city, we had a vantage of a couple thousand feet looking down on blankness, the broad arms of Lake La Huntan wrapping around islands and peninsulas. The lake would have gone past every horizon we could see from here. The city was swallowed in its own dust storm, industry stirring up the playa. Forklifts, cranes, and front-end loaders were teeming, preparing for the opening of the gates, too far away to pick out with binoculars. All we could see was a shimmering point, a dome of dust miles across. It was a ritual, a festival, an annual gathering, and from up here, in a clean wind, it looked too dusty for comfort. The consensus was that we were going, but being alone in the vast arms of La Huntan had its appeal. Dr. John said, "It's like Obi-Wan and Luke looking over that city in the desert. What was it, a hive of scum and villainy?" Mos Eisley said Q, referring to the scene in Star Wars, one of the legends we have been telling in our time. "They just had to go," said the doctor. "It was their quest." Our quest was to get to the city. We had tickets to get in. My eye kept darting back to where we'd come from, the sweet isolation we'd been passing through. We were looking down into the dry chap of what is known as the Quinn River, a northern arm of La Huntan that once reached into Oregon. 30 miles from the city, the Quinn River flows down to this pan of salts and crunchy evaporites, where it disappears, not enough water to feed a lake. From up here, it looked like an empty delta, a place you'd expect to see rusted ships keeled on their sides. The opposite shore, 20 miles away from us, is the foot of the Jackson Mountains, one of the largest islands on La Hontan. A Colombian mammoth skeleton was found on the shores of the Jackson Mountains. It is the largest complete mammoth skeleton in the United States, excavated in 1982 during a summer of 120-degree heat. A report from the site reads, "A sudden violent sandstorm one day reduced visibility to zero, but caused no damage except to human eyes and skin." Among the bones of this mammoth, human tools and pieces of stone weapons were found, with some question as to whether they were associated with the mammoth or they just happened to be in the same place at a later date, and the two deflated into each other over time. The excavators also found the milk tooth of a young saber-toothed cat, enough to bring up a tantalizing scene, a carcass fought over by two species, two-legged versus four, on the remains of an enormous beast, spears and shouting. This mammoth, which has a single contested radiocarbon date of 11,000 years old, may have been sighted on the shores of a mountainous island in the middle of La Hontan. Hunters swam across the blue water, weapons bundled on their backs, perhaps pursuing the last of the last. There has been funded, legitimate talk in scientific circles about genetically reviving the mammoth, bringing it back from the other side of extinction. It is being called reparation for a mistake we made as a species, a practice run at bringing back animals we drove out of existence. Though I'd be amazed to see a live mammoth in my own age, I'd be equally horrified. Before waving the flag of what is being called de-extinction, understand that this would not be an Ice Age mammoth woken to the 21st century as if from a block of ice. This would be a mammophant. 45 mammoth genes have been sequenced out of the thousands more needed, and the remainder would come from an Asian elephant. The horrified part of me asks what danger lies in uncorking, mixing, and letting loose this genetic material. But after corn with chromosomes turned to pesticides and goats producing spider webs in their milk, that question feels like it's come and gone. My more immediate concern is what happens when a large, charismatic pioneer is released into a new world, every horizon a possibility. Think zebra mussels, kudzu vines, but with tusks. If it worked, and more than a genetic slime in a petri dish was created, if we came up with a creature that was part elephant and part mammoth, what will we have done? The introduction of new species is a primary driver of modern extinctions. Pushing an already extinct animal into a world having trouble holding on to what it already has is an entirely different kind of acceleration, another ball thrown into the circus ring. How long would this invented species last, beyond the age of governments and Pleistocene parks? From this summit, I could point one hand at the mammoth find at the foot of the Jackson Mountains, and with the other point 180 degrees away at Burning Man and its rising dust. Towering art sculptures and temples were being built in the desert. 70,000 participants expected this year, the same year our global population was pushing 7 billion. This would become the third largest city in Nevada, behind Reno and Las Vegas, and it would be ephemeral, rising on the same lake bottom every year in a matter of weeks. Two ends of time felt as if they were balanced across the fulcrum of this rocky summit. 10,000 years in the past on one side, and everything to come after on the other. For a moment, all the disjointed pieces of time felt in equilibrium. The next morning, 2 days from the city, we were camped on the lake bottom, on the open face of nothing. A storm rolled in before dawn, and by first light, thunderheads sparked with lightning. Fat dots of rain fell as the old lake bed woke and began talking back to itself. I was out of my sleeping bag, crouched with only the contact of my shoe soles on the ground. The air flashed white. 4 seconds later, thunder pounded my eardrums. Q would tell me that he saw blue zaps of electricity on some of the gear. I made as little contact as I could, thinking an umbrella would be helpful in the rain, but not wanting to make myself the tallest point on the playa. The storm hammered the city, now about 7 miles away, At dawn, I counted 12 ground strikes, direct hits inside the enclave of structures, where wooden effigies and temples pointed at the sky like lightning rods. The storm had found its mark. As if the heavens were making a point, the entire sky seemed to be drawn to the city, lightning and rain pulled from all directions and mashed into the ground by the thumb of God. We've only learned the tool of the lever, the advantage of the atlatl, making ourselves larger than we actually are, as weights of weather and climate are being thrown around, the sky doing as it pleases. Scientists have come together to name the next geologic epoch, a change we are very much part of, not so different from Clovis Age people watching the Ice Age crumble. Many say the Holocene has ended, and we are entering a new age. It is a time of widespread extinctions and unraveling climates, superstorms and inundated cities. We are rolling out this new age with confetti and cheers, cabinets and scientific committees trying to decide if it began 2,800 years ago when the iron smelters of Carthage first left carbon layers in the ice caps, or if the atomic age marks the real start, the explosion at the Trinity site kicking us off the ledge. The name of this period doesn't matter so much. Historians may find it recorded in the tiniest threads of writing, amused perhaps at our inventiveness. We call it Anthropocene. It means new man, the time of humans. I prefer Hubricene. I'm a fan of the Holocene, the time we're in, or at least have been since the close of the Ice Age. The Pleistocene was a death trap of teeth, claws, and glaciers, while nobody knows what to make of the upcoming Anthropocene. We seem to be bookended by the fierce and the uncharted. Am I sentimental to hold on to our familiar age? Who is not in love with these blue skies pillared with clouds and the many species around us, the way more oxygen comes out of the ocean than methane, the deep breathing of forests and grasslands? I do not want this party to end. Yet another one seems to be starting, pushed on stage with zeal. I've listened to the findings of climate researchers in Greenland as storms howled around our tents, snow building against us. I've gone out with NASA atmospheric researchers to drop remote sensing stations and have heard how much the climate is evolving and how fast ice caps deflate and the Gulf Stream starts a wobble dance in the Atlantic, then settles back down. On this thin skin of air, water, and soil, I've read reams of scientific papers, looked at bubbles in unsheathed ice cores. I asked scientists the same question so many times, can it be changed? Can we redirect this? The answer was always yes. This is nothing but change. Flap your arms, it could have an effect. But can we come back to where we were? That inquiry is met with different answers. Mostly, no. You can never go back. There is only the world ahead. As the storm let up, we could hear the arrhythmic pounding of DJs. The city roared and thrummed into a storm-blasted sunrise, as if the lightning had only increased the energy. They were shouting at the sky for more. By nightfall, all memory of the rain was gone. A bony, dead coyote lay on the pan where it had dropped months ago. Light of the Milky Way powdered across the sky. We'd made it to within a few miles of the city. Now we could see volleys of flame shooting upward. A continuous wave of sound rolled across the desert. Lasers fired out of what, in my binoculars, looked like the wingless fuselage of a passenger jet that had been trucked in. This was Bull Brook and Lindenmeyer on a 21st century scale, something people living along these late Ice Age shores would have understood, at least in concept. Come together. Make yourselves into one. We were playing out one of our oldest stories, the myth of the eternal return, gathering to mark time and make a ritual of ourselves. This is how people continue. We bring stories to each other, learning what has been witnessed, what the scouts have seen, what new ideas have bubbled up. We show each other our maps, our tools, mixing genes and languages. This has been happening since the beginning. People with stemmed weapons from the Ice Age wove through those with fluted technology, and out came the classic Indian arrowhead, a small stemmed projectile affixed to the end of an arrow shaft. The bases of these points were finely napped into various kinds of barbs, ears, tangs, or notches, possible attributes of the fluted tradition. As the curtain rose on the Holocene, Native America began with an estimated 1,000 languages, genes going back to Clovis' age, if not older. The arrowhead that finally appeared, now part of a bow and arrow technology more suited to deer and rabbit, was what came out of this Holocene aggregation, a sort of agreement. As we stood in the desert, at the edge of the burning city, I thought about not going, not being part of the next great aggregation on this lake. We all thought about it. The horizon was ablaze. Lasers struck us where we stood, illuminating the lake bed. It seemed like too much, a grandstanding civilization up on its tiptoes, calling everyone it could reach. Is no animal or habitat safe in our path? I wanted to take my tools, my pen and paper, and turn the other way. I didn't want to be party to this very human mania, the unending urges of a species hell-bent on colonizing anything it touches. But I remain a student of legends. I can't help poking at the stories that I hear, giving them a little flame, sending up sparks. Etta, from Bali, the most recent arrival among us, took up her fiddle. She ducked away and waltzed across the playa, her song spilling out. It was a gypsy wail, and as she played, I thought it was a song I knew in my deepest heart, picking up a stringed instrument, coming to the edge, and plucking a tune. This is how we have taken hold, moving a melody into impossible places, scratching the bones of a mammoth in a remote valley at the beginning of time. On another lakeshore, a smaller nearby arm, is a series of rock art panels dated to 14,800 years ago. A carbon-bearing mineral formed every time the lake rose and inundated the rock art, leaving a patina that could be dated. The layers of patina span from 14,800 to about 10,500 years ago, glyphs added consecutively every time the lake dropped. Between 14,800 to 13,100 years ago, the boulders were exposed to air and people worked on them. Lake levels rose and submerged the boulders for a couple thousand years, and exposed them again from 11,300 to 10,500 years ago, when people picked up the task as if they'd never stopped. This is continuity, a remembered place over the final 5,000 years of the Ice Age. I traveled to this ancient rock art with my family, one of the last road trips we took together, my lap strewn with maps as my wife drove across empty basins and ranges along a Nevada highway. The rock art was not a marked locality. Finding it took some triangulation, reading between the lines of archaeological reports. We had it narrowed down to a sub-basin within La Huntan, an arm of an arm. A winding dirt road led us to a barbed wire cattle gate, the sign saying to close it behind us. Out of a clutter of empty juice boxes and camping gear, we spilled into the Nevada desert. A spring came out of the mountainside, its source roughly fenced with barbed wire. A clear stream issued from the ground, watercress waving in the current as the spring flowed out of its luscious vegetated enclosure, down to the cattle-smashed slope below. A squared fence was all that kept the spring from becoming a trampled, muddy crater. It was an emerald on the hill, a point of life and yarrow flowers. As we walked by, we stopped for the bumblebees and birds inhabiting this gushing well, this emergence. In the Ice Age, it must have roared. As kids glided ahead through the dry grass of midsummer, we found signs of occupation. Some of the bulbous tufa formations had eroded open and were hollow inside, their floors buried in wood rat droppings, rough ceilings blackened with smoke. At night, these must have looked like a hive, lights flickering atop each other at the edge of a lake, people living as if in a clutch of grapes. Paisley, in Oregon, would have looked similar, the caves lit along the edge of their own lake at about the same time, give or take a few hundred centuries. The tufa is like pumice, easy to etch or scratch. We found a flat-faced boulder of this rock that had been deeply cross-hatched by human tools. Well-worn, the geometric grooves were lightly coated with minerals from the rise and fall of the lake behind it, now dried to a salty crisp. Both kids were mildly impressed, but more interested in tearing off, playing tag, and racing across the slope. Here people had been making the first banners of themselves, the original drive-in theaters. They had stood in this same place, their feet beneath ours. Jado, with a 16-stitch Alaskan scar on his forehead, looked at the rock art and said, "I don't know what's the big deal about a bunch of X's," and he ran away. I felt as if I'd been going from landmark to landmark, asking, "Are you my mother?" Like a lost child on a lost continent, I searched to root myself and find solid ground. I visited the oldest sites as if on a pilgrimage, stopping to recognize those who came before, lineages upon lineages, arrivals upon arrivals, leading back to the first flicker of a campfire, a panel of